So,
why is it okay with you?
Right. I was not planning to spend that much on the first two chapters, the one dedicated to literature, which is, I think, is very straightforward, and the one dedicated to English. However, I think that I can mention something general, which is probably is going to come back later. Let's go from the big picture to the small picture. Before the 15th century in Europe, was not, well, the idea to have a common language was unthinkable. Were too many regions, if you want, because country, the idea of the country didn't exist at that stage. Were too many people with too many interests, and the exchange that people was having was grounded basically on economical reasons. I mean, commerce, if you want, navigations, and in that case, it's only, let's say, at the beginning of the 10th century in which Europe started to have some impact on the control of what is, or what was the main purpose of communication. Before that, were the Arabic countries and the eastern regions of the planet who were really on charge. That means that the idea that some kind of language from Europe could become the language of the money, if you want, was even unthinkable before the 15th century. What happened in the 15th century is, as you know, is that all these, let's say, projects, in one way or the other, who were connected with science, with art, who were, in one way or the other, sleeping during the medieval times, came to public. And then it is when different areas, like, I don't know, if you want, Venezia in Italy, became a very, very powerful area in terms of commerce and exchange and so on. So at that moment was a moment in which the language that these people was bringing in one way or the other was start to be considered as the language of, let's say, the communication, basically. That is the start. You have a huge important element, which is the Latin during the on top of this. You have this dominance grounded on religion, if you want. The language of the religion was Latin, which is not necessarily the Latin that people later will be speaking in the street, because it has a Greek, as you know, if you study Greek nowadays, you study the classical Greek, is, well, there are some connections, but it's not modern Greek, it's different. Latin is the same. It was one Latin on the street, if you want, and the Latin, which is the if you want, the official one. So, the language of the philosophy, the language of the books, if you want, during the whole, let's say, between the 8th century up to the 14th, 15th century, was Latin. And all the other dialects, it's difficult to call it language, who were surrounding Latin one way in Europe, were called Slavic languages, barbarian languages, and later, more appropriate if you want, Romance languages. Alright? So, why 15th century is important is not only because it's the date in which we can ground the Renaissance and all the meanings that Renaissance have, but also is because it's the moment in which these languages who were working outside the Latin start to, in one way or the other, to grow. Not because the people who was speaking this language were the people outside the intellectual environment who became important, but because the exchange of the people started to be more, to happen more frequently, in one way or the other, and not necessarily because economical reasons as was before. People start to travel quite, not a lot, but more than before, Even if there are conditions, I should give you an example. During the medieval times, medieval times was a very big one, but generally speaking, the expectation of life was 32 years. So people was living no more than 32 years old. And when people was arriving at 16 or 17, they were having all kinds of sickness. So as you see, the conception of life was huge, immensely different than nowadays. So we hardly can apply all the concept that we have about life now to what happened there. However, what was true is that considering, let's say, the 8th century in relation with the 12th century, in the 12th century people was traveling more. And the idea that in some ways were artists who were touring one place to the other became important. Why? Because these people who were touring were bringing the plot, if you will, but also the language. And the language was not Latin, because these people was not having the structure and education to produce that in Latin. And also because these stories, these trovadores, as they call it, they were targeting an audience who were not intellectual, were the people on, you know, public houses and places like that. For some people, that is the origin of literature in Europe, is when the trovadores, they call it as well juglares in Spanish. I use Spanish because the Spaniards were important in that period. And so you have immensely huge amount of people, but quite a decent amount of people traveling from Germany to Spain and from Spain to Germany, for example. This was the base of what we is called later, what considered one of the first gender in literature. We call it picaresca, who have no translation in another language. The picaresca is this, is a picaro. This was this character, this young, here to an adolescent person who were traveling one place to the other, telling these stories about people, you know, about what people do, how they steal things, how they survive, basically, what kind of job they do, and so on. The main work on this is a work called Lazarillo de Tormes. It's one of the majors on picaresca. It's the figure of these men, you know, the old man and the young one. It's a typical from different plots. Even in Asia, you have this idea. In the case of Lazarillo is mean come from Lazarus, but this referred to the fact that the man was blind. The old man was blind. I was having this child, it was near to adolescent, let's say maybe 12, 13, 14. There is no specification about the age, but we get that. So the child is the kind of the eyes of the blind man. And they were touring, they were traveling. Sometimes they were making account of stories, the guy made. Sometimes they were stealing things. So they take life as they can. So that's the meaning of a picaro. It's someone who is able to survive, doesn't matter what condition you are facing. So you are a survivor. And you do whatever it takes to do that. But always, if you have the possibility to do the things in a more clear and direct direction, you prefer the other one because it's more fun. So that's the idea of the picaro. It's a very short book, sort of difficult Spanish because it's Spanish from that period. But it's more or less for cases like this, that the possibility that maybe four or five languages are going to start to grow in one way or the other. Not in the way we understand nowadays as a corpus with rules and so on, but a kind of coherence. The vocabulary start to be more coherent. Some regions start to have more frequent exchange. And of course, what is going to happen is that the idea that a central authority should be at the top of the priority in a particular piece of land help this quite substantially, because when you centralize the authority in terms of, you know, taxes, in terms of administration, in terms of who is the authority and so on, then you centralize basically everything, because all the people from that particular land refer to that particular central power. And that also is a way in which this idea of new languages start to grow. And then you have basically a period of evolution. But let's say that around, I don't know, that date, 1605 to 1675, something like that, this idea that we have languages that for which we need to create some kind of grammar came up. An example, all the grammar of Port-Royal in France came up more or less in that period. All the idea of Nebrija, which was an author who created grammar for the Spaniards, came up in that. Even more, the academy who was created in Spain to take care about the properties and the properness of the languages came up in that 17th century. And then since then has been growing and growing and growing. Why I'm saying this is because what we understand as a literature, the author agrees in the fact that this idea of literature is grounded on the evolution and development of those Romance languages. All right? Because the genders that we understand as literature now were grounded in that particular period. Because basically the possibility to evolve, because the idea of literature grounded in the classics mean, if you want, in one way or another, Latin and Greek were very fixed, because that was the idea. The idea that you have a parameters was la retórica, in which you have a very clear rules about how you can produce a piece of art and what is art and what is not. That was very, very sophisticated during the Greek period and even during the Latin period. So the possibility to change that were, well, very, very remotely. And that's why these became so powerful in the 17th and 18th century, because what was called as classic art was completely shaken up by these new languages who were bringing new genders, basically narration, because that narration was something that was not associated with literature in the classic period, but with history. And that's really is a big change, if you want, one way or the other. And of course, the peak of this evolution will be when, at the beginning, and let's say in 1790-something, 1780-something, the more primitive form of novel came out. Because a novel, if you want, is the peak of this evolution of the Romance languages. And then you have all the evolution of literature during the 19th century, or more formalization of the languages, and so on. Why am I explaining this to you? This, well, for two reasons. First one, so you have a, you know, quickly, this is a huge simplification, of course. There are several issues there that maybe need to be addressed. But just, you have an idea that this moment, nowadays, in which we have a vehicular language, English, who is dominant all over the planet, is not new. Happened before. Happened in the Greek period, and happened in the Roman period, and happened in the medieval times, in which a language was a language of the work, and was a language of the intellect, and that was Latin. So, normally people was knowing two or three languages, what we call it, so, speak language. One was Latin, because it was the language of the art, and the other was the language of where you coming from, an example. That was very common among the priests and the monks, an example. And there are, well, accounts of priests and monks who were speaking maybe 16, 18 languages. And that has been a tradition in Europe. I mean, just give you a personal, my grand-grandfather used to speak 16 languages, and that was beginning of 17-something. So that was Europe, basically. The idea that a vehicular language always was there. Who was the language of the work? Sometimes was the language of the art, and then the other language were complementary. What What was not extreme as nowadays is the fact that one language was absolutely associated with a particular activity. An example, Spinoza. Spinoza, as you know, is a philosopher who was living in Amsterdam. Her father was coming from North Europe, he was Flemish. Her mother was coming from a Spanish background. He normally was speaking Yiddish, a sort of Yiddish, for religion reason. He was speaking Spanish with the mother, and he was speaking sort of German or Flemish with the father. And on top of that, he knew Latin and classic and Greek because he was studying philosophy. So the fact that, for example, all the arts in terms of humanities for him was associated with Spanish. All the art connected with philosophy for him was connected with Latin. And that's why he wrote the first book in Latin, you see. So what is different now, and that's had to do with the chapter of this man in the year of the race of English, is that one language is completely associated absolutely with the two or three activities, which is work, technical issues if you want, and art and humanities issues, you see. And this is what is new. Because it used to be more, well, it used to be in a communication, no one language was that language, you see. However, the idea that we were working with two or three languages at different levels with different functions already happened before. Something similar happened during the 17th and 18th century of French, an example. If you were a diplomat and you were working in diplomacy, French was a language to write letters, to communicate with people, and to do things. If you're doing some science during the 19th century, where science was divided in two, everything who was connected with earth, meteorology and so on, was in French. Everything connected with physics, chemistry and so on was German. And that was a common language of the 19th century, you see. But, as I say, they were not absolutely comprehensive language. They were just, you know, partially an example. Let's say in chemistry everything was done in Germany. So, therefore, German was the language of that. Meteorology, all the Faros observatory and everything who was in this planet were owned by the French people because they were taking care about this measurement of things and so on. Therefore, the manuals, all the people working there were speaking French. That's the reason why when you were having a pilot in a port, one of the conditions was that you should speak French in the 19th century. And now, of course, when you are a pilot of an aircraft, you need to speak English. Because when you communicate with the tower, well, forget it. I mean, if you don't know how English, that's it. So, that's to give you an idea, to compare, historically speaking. What is the point of this man? And this, again, is the point which is different, is that the situation is new and different now because this dominance, because the dominance is absolute, especially the language of computing, which is completely reshape the idea of what is knowledge, what is philosophy and everything, and we are just at the beginning. This is going to be more and more and more and more. So, what possibility can have an activity, an artistic activity, which condition has been the multiplication of language? If literature has been fruitful and has been developed quite substantially, is, this man said, because we are having all those languages. And it's the encounter of those languages who has been producing this beautiful piece of work. So, if we are going to face a planet or a situation or environment in which everything is going to be dominated by our language, what is the space for literature there? This is any space. And that's bringing me to the other point I was trying to discuss, the idea of languages and literature. Of course, nowadays you have basically, let's say, three positions regarding to this problem. Number one, literature is dead. Number two, literature is not dead. It's going to be reformulated in another way, different, but the fact that we have one dominant language is not going to change that much. And number three is a medium position, in which they say, yes, some aspects of literature are gone forever, and some other aspects are going to be new and different. So it's just a matter of how we deal with it. Majority of the authors tend to think that effectively literature, as we understood, is dead. Another proportion, decent one, try to make an equilibrium saying, well, an example, the web could be as well a way to do some literature different. Virtual literature, an example. And the real minority are the ones who says that literature isn't, you cannot touch it. And the value for literature are always there. because it's so difficult to see that. I mean, even if you agree that human values need to be expressed in artistic form, and if you agree that that doesn't matter what condition you are suffering as a human being, or what you are going to manage to express yourself, yes, maybe that's true, generally speaking, for artistic purpose, but who says the only artistic possibility to express yourself is literature? Dreams, objects, who knows? So that is the weak position, if you want, one way or the other. Right. The thing with the language is this. I just give you the picture of the discussion, main discussion about language and literature. Basically, the 19th century has been the century in which all these issues about what is the meaning of a language, what is the purpose of a language, has been basically discussed. What we have now today, we have more refined and sophisticated perspective of those discussions. But there are no other findings or ways to think the language who really can change that much. And we talk about basically, if you want, two positions. Maybe if we force a little bit, could be three. But basically, there are two positions. Remember the explanation we made in the last class about the idea of realism. You see, so you have a man here, and you have the world here. If the world is autonomous and have his own logic and sense, and if the purpose of man to be a man with knowledge is to understand nature, therefore to understand himself in a better way, then the linguistics who were thinking in the 19th century, before, but in a more formal way in the 19th century, were saying, okay, language always are natural language. We do not create the language, we discover the language because we need to talk the language of nature. Well, so as more close our language is to the rules of nature, more true and better this language is going to be. So basically, we talk about an idea of language who is determined by society, or if you want, by the laws who were grounded in the natural law and who can explain society and therefore can explain language. So you, as a human being, do not have any, let's say, impact in the way to make that different. You can impact on the language because you grow up yourself with the language. You can change it. You can introduce new concepts and so on. But the structure of the language is outside you, is in the society, is in nature. All right? That's position number one. Position number two, as you imagine, is the other way around. It's when people will say, no, you know, the idealism. They say, the reality is not here. Why? Because we cannot be outside the world ever. For example, these men. Schopenhauer was a German who made this idea of idealism, probably is one of the masters of idealism, philosophically speaking. He was saying this, basically. I have a complicated book, but basically the idea was that you ever can be in such a position in which you say, the world is there, I'm here, ever. Always you are surrounded by things. So it's hardly that you can have that distance. So therefore you are in the world. So the only way that you can come up to some kind of idea of language is if you work yourself. You see, so the idea of language is grounded not necessarily in one individual, but it's grounded on people. So you need to understand how the people think and what the people believe to understand the idea of language. You see, it's the other way around. So language is on you. So you can imagine, if you want one position or the other, the distinctions are huge. Because in one case, you are going to study nature and society, and therefore language. In the other, you are going to study, I don't know, the human soul, the philosophical concern of the human being, and then you are going to study the language, if you want. So, for the first one, they call it natural language, and the second one, they call it human languages, if you want, in one way, just to make clear the distinction. Basically, since, let's say, 1820s, up today, all the discussion have to do with this. There are no really secrets, there are no, of course, there are very sophisticated approach, because as soon linguistic became an area, let's say, in the 1915, there is a school called the School of Praga, because it was in Praga, and we did this linguistic came up, well, very sophisticated analysis about linguistics came up, but when philosophical issues came up to discuss what is the ground on which we work in linguistics, these two discussions are always the same. They don't change. So, there is a hypothesis who has been very popular and famous, who was produced in the 30s of this last century, 1930s, who were coming from these two men, Shapir. I'm sure you came across a Worf, who were the most successful in linguistics. Because you see, let me put it this way. Let's assume that you are someone that would like to study languages. So you have two possibilities. You can go and study nature to understand language, or you can go and study people and society to learn language. So let's pretend that you are linguistic. If you need to choose, which one you're going to choose? Why? Why?
You can interact.
Yeah. Yeah. Because not only that, it's because it's the easy way. Because you can make a survey. You can see how they talk, how they write. I mean, if you go for nature, you become a scientist. You need to study chemistry or biology or whatever, you see. So that is why, exactly that's the reason why linguistics turn to be more focused on that. And that is when these men came up. Because they were saying that the structure of the language determines the structure of the society. You see, this is a more short, brief, and effective formulation of this idea that when you are a linguistic, you go to study society understood as people, understood as a community of people who share a particular code, a particular dictionary, a particular encyclopedia. Of course, still, there are some linguistic work in another way, but these people became more connected with naturalism, with physiology, and it's the people who nowadays study, an example, the connection between the brain and the language. I mean, it's people who always try to ground the language anatomically speaking. Because you see, this is the scheme is very simple. If you believe that nature gives you the rules on which you are living, what are you going to do? You study your anatomy, because if you study your anatomy, then you study your mechanism as an animal, and then you are going to understand your connection with other animals, and so on. So if you are a linguistic, you are going to study anatomy to see how you work. An example, I used to have a friend, well, I have a friend, a lady who is working on the idea that if you have a kid who grow up with two languages, the left side of your brain develop quite substantially more, and they make scans, they make everything, they're very convinced that if you make a scan you can guess if this child was grow up with two languages or only one, because apparently there are some capabilities that anatomically speaking became developed, and that is not the case for someone who grow up with language. But the point I discuss with her always is, okay, fine, let's assume that's correct, so what? Who cares? I mean, this is the whole thing. You can identify some kind of metabolism who has been changed in your body because the way in which you live. Yeah, but that's happened every day. It's not only with language. I mean, if you drink 1 liter of wine a meal, well, then you became my colleague. That's it. Your body changed. And so what? I mean, you see, what other conclusion you can extract from this? You see, it's a, like a no way exit, in the sense in which you constat, you make certainty that there are some elements, anatomically speaking, who can be connected with the language, but later you need something else, because you need to put that in context, and that is the weakest point of this, and that's why the majority of the linguistics has been going for the other approach. So, why I'm explaining this to you is because the whole thing here is, what about literature? What is bloody literature have to do with this? Well, this is the whole point. When this discussion starts, these men, as Schopenhauer, were saying that philosophy and literature are grounded in the same. They have different styles, but the principle is the same. They try to make sense about the language, in a sense in which if you have a place which is the ideal place to exercise that freedom of language, because you need to be clear on this, If you believe the nature determines your language, you will have freedom. You need to understand the rules who are, you know, are grounding your language. But if you are running for the other more social or individual orientated hypothesis, you have complete freedom. Because are the men who decide what language they need to have. I mean, you know, it's famous, this idea from the Bible, Babel, who has been discussed as well a lot in the 19th century, the idea that God, to punish the men, put all the same in the same building, but everyone was speaking a different language. So Babel always is a metaphor of how people in their own, without any extra help, not from nature, not from God, can communicate. Is that possible? Well, these people will be saying yes. And Schopenhauer and other people were saying, okay, philosophy and literature have this common core. So literature is that activity who make a full use of the language to explore the limit, you see? Because basically they were saying, you have this framework which is your language. So if you keep working always there, the tendency, they were saying, is that you use less and less word in one way or the other, because people start to know each other more and more and more. They establish like a sort of law, which is in some ways have some true elements. Let's have a look at English, an example. The English that really speak people nowadays is not English, come on. I mean, it's something that there are 15 verbs, 20 adjectives or substantives, and that's it. I mean, doesn't matter. I mean, when I have a couple of friends who are now near to 60, who they were making English as a major, and they have been, well, in Oxford and Cambridge, and when they speak another language, which is sound English, but it's completely different. You see? So, what I'm saying to you is that as more people use a particular vehicular language, more than language became short and short and short and short. If you have a conversation in an airport with a foreigner, I mean, not someone who is an Anglo-Saxon speaker, you realize that. They express themselves, but they always go back. They have four or five sentences, who is just, they turn around one way or the other, and always are the same and the same and the same. And they manage very well. People do not notice that. Yeah, I ever came across to someone and I was thinking, oh, what a poor vocabulary. No, the guy was correct, proper, fine, but I don't think he was using more than seven verbs. And of course, I mean, the verbs, the conjunction were very simple one, you know, nothing complicated, you know. So, because of that, they say literature should be allocated here. And the tax for writers and poets is force the language. And the task of literature is to put name to things and situations who do not have yet a name. That is that in Greek is episteme, who is science studies, means in Greek, but this is exactly the word. When you have a discipline who try to understand how people understand, you have a discipline who try to understand how the language works. You see, it's when you take a step back, you see, and you try to see things, to see how they work. Not in the sense in which how many concepts you use. No. What kind of concept they are using. You see, you take back a step and have a perspective which is a sort of overall. That is the idea. And that is the purpose. Of course, you have two possibilities here, as Schopenhauer said in the 19th century. You can be a philosopher, and then what is interest to you, more than work with the language, is work with the beliefs and the system of beliefs who make language possible. Then you are a philosopher. If you're a writer, you don't care that much about the belief. You use the belief to produce an object in which people are going to be, or in some ways, feel an identification or understand much better things. Why? Because you put name to things who do not have name. An example, I'm sure you came across a situation in which someone asks you about a book. You say you like it. And when the person asks you why you like it, you know how to say it. Why? Well, this is what, because it's literature, is working with the areas in which you are You know, it's like a dark, you know, you tend to, sometimes researcher put a finger in one direction and you can see the direction, but if someone asks you about what kind of things or what is there, how you feel, you don't have a clue. But you see the window, you see, the thing is that you don't see what is outside the window, because, you know, that's when language works properly, or let's put it, literature works properly, you are working with the limits. So that basically was what was in mind of these people who was starting to think the idea of language, and the people who was trying to justify literature, because this is something that we discussed slightly the last time, and it's important. It's only in the 19th century that the people, I mean in terms of Romance languages of course, that people start to think in what they were doing as an artist. Okay? Before that period, people were producing objects and they were not thinking that much about what they were doing. Of course, you can say to me, Claudio, you have someone like a Michelangelo who was in the Renaissance thinking and doing a lot of things. Yes, but Michelangelo and other people, they were more than thinking what they were doing. They were thinking how many things they can think. And that's different. So Michelangelo was a painter, was a philosopher, was a poet, and so on. But he never spent that much time to say, okay, let's stop here and let's have an essay who I'm going to analyze why I was doing painting and as well philosophy. Why that happened? That why only was possible in the 19th century. Why? Because the evolution of the art is what made this why possible. You need to have some kind of critical mass, you see. What Michelangelo and other people was doing was making the ground. So were necessary 200 years to the people to say, okay, now we have a critical mass. Now we think, what is the sense of this evolution? What is the sense of this expression? You see? So that is why that happened. And before that, it was a matter of technique. An example, you have, if you read the Giornali from Michelangelo, there is a lot of reflection on techniques. An example, how make the shadows. An example, why is important to make the sketch or not to make the sketch in a particular painting. I mean, you see, this is more than a reflection about art. It's a reflection about technique, because at that point art was associated with technique. You see, was the idea that as more perfection technique you have, better artist you are. What we realized in the 19th century is that is not necessarily true, because there is an element of uncertainty that you cannot control, and it's the element the romantic people call inspiration. Because if you ask someone, how it was possible for you, who were someone who has no education, who came from a family who was in jail, who was having quite a lot of problems, who have an education, yes, but very, very painful one, because the teachers were kicking you and so on. This is Dickens. They ask him, why that was possible? I don't know. Who's there? You call it talent? Of course, there isn't a craft, experience, and things like that. Yes. But what Aristotle called the engine, the when you put in the engine to work, that first movement, there is no necessary explanation for that, no technical one. I mean, how someone who was, I don't know, having that experience can write hard times. I mean, when you were thinking, if someone were trying to do something better, would we be walking away from that kind of environment? So, just to give you an example, so what is what really is the point since then, or has been the point since then, relating to language, is how far literature can go in this kind of analysis. Because remember, literature at the beginning of the 19th century was like the queen, if you want, of the disciplines. Later, during the 19th century and the 20th century, literature was making concession to other disciplines. An example, linguistics. Linguistics at the beginning did not exist as a discipline, was part of literature. So all the people who were trying to study language were studying humanities, who were basically literature. But then when the evolution of the discipline started to grow, you have a difference. Sociology was taking his part, politics were taking his part, history was claiming as well as his part. So seems that the idea of literature was reducing more and more and more and more and more. at such a point that nowadays people, blind people, ordinary people, associate literature with fiction, which according to this is completely wrong. Because if you do that, then literature, yes, is dead. Excluding if you have an idea of fiction who could be a philosophical one, which is different, but there are not that many people who have a philosophical idea about fiction. For example, Borges. If you read Borges, fiction, yes, he had a philosophical idea about fiction. But the rest of the people, fiction is a plot in which you enjoy yourself, you read the book, and you trash it. You notice that people do not keep bestsellers. They trash it. They give it away. Even some of my colleagues, academics. Why? Because that's the idea of fiction. The idea that you enjoy something, you entertain yourself, and that's it. You don't keep that book. See? So, all the theories, literary theory, since then, up to today, has been focused on this. How scientific we can make literature. How abstract we can go. How formal our analysis can go. The first movement where the if you want, in this way, specifically in literature, were the formalists, the Russian formalists. They talk about something who is called the study of literature, they call it, but it is the, how we can translate this in English? The property of being literature. How we call that? You see, because what these people was focusing is what make literature specific? What is the core that make literature specific in relation with others? Discipline. That was the main question for these people, from the Russian formalists. And they create, if you want, this proper idea of a study of literature in our society, if you want, in one way or the other. This was not really a movement where people working in different moments in Russia, most of them are at the beginning, if you want, of the century. After that you have movements on literature who go close to linguistics, movements on literature who go close to semiotics, movements on literature who again claim back that they need to be autonomous, and so on. There is a huge amount of, we are going to see some of them. But this is the picture, you see. So, in one way or the other, this is what this guy was trying to give you. Maybe with another perspective in a less broad sense. But this is the picture that you should have in your mind when you are going to face the theory of the 20th century about literature. You see, because what these theories imply is all this past about the language, about how you can see the language. So, this is a message, well, it was a message for Simon, but as well for you. Because this explanation I give it to you, you can understand now why what is a discussion in literature is as well a discussion in philosophy and linguistics. The material is different, the sources are different, but the discussion is the same. You have sociolinguistics, an example. In sociolinguistics, you have two positions. People think that you need to figure out the law, and they go, you know, for the law, if you want what they call natural language, or people who believe that you need to make a survey and understand how the people speak, because of the way to understand the language. So that's the two approaches in sociolinguistics nowadays, if you want. So you see, and again in philosophy, the same. You have nowadays two kind of approaches to philosophy. The philosophy more and more go close to science, that you can call real, if you want, philosophy, who they believe, you know, that science in one way or the other is history of science, number one, and number two is a kind of reflection about what philosophy is a kind of religion about what science is, right? And you have in the other extreme the other people who say no, philosophy is about a fundamental questions, and the fundamental questions are different in each human being. So this is called constructivism. So problems are defined by people and by local environment, therefore you cannot have universal claims as science tried to do, you see. And basically philosophy nowadays is like that. You have someone who are in the middle, yeah, a little bit here, a little bit there, the analytics, an example, but not that much. I mean, the real strong epistemological discussion, when the moments come, this is the two discussions. People who are in favor of science, and what is the meaning of science, and philosophy of science, and people who believe that we should ground more in what was traditionally philosophy, more in a humanities approach, philosophy, you see. questions? No? It's simple, but it's important to have in back of your mind this, because this is the this explains quite a lot of things when you are going to say why these people are discussing this, why they bother so much with one thing or the other. You see, this is the answer. And of course, I mean, if you look this in terms of historical evolution, well, it's huge. If you an example you can pick it up from linguistic point of view, Humboldt, who was one of the master of linguistics, who create Humboldt is a man from the 2 centuries, I mean 17th century and 18th century and 18th century, so he has been doing things in the 2 centuries. He is a huge, his complete work are 42 volumes, he's a monument, he's not a man. And then if you took from him today, well, huge, all the development linguistic, all the systems, all the theories, all the concepts, I mean, you're going to spend your entire life studying that. But to be honest with you, when the moments come to discuss, things are very, very simple. Because what they do is, on the ground of one or the other, they build up all these systems. So at the end, the system is hyper sophisticated, really terribly complex to understand, but the ground is so simple.
Did this start the difficulty of science and the humanity approach with the Enlightenment then?
To some extension, yes, but not necessarily, because the Enlightenment is still pretty much a moment in which science were conceived from the humanity point of view. Because this is, you see, what is interesting is up to the middle of the 19th century, all the science were receiving humanity's formation and structure. All of them. So you were a science, but that do not prevent you to receive a classical humanitarian instruction in university, and that was part of the curriculum. So all the people was aware that the whole picture of science was done and ground on this humanity perspective. You see, that completely changed with two or three issues. Number one, with the way in which physics started to be grounded in mathematics more and more. That happened in the middle of the 19th century. Then with way in which a discipline like a chemistry start to be more and more abstract, because they use less and less narration in traditional way and more formulas and so on. So what happened at some point is that the universities in Germany stopped to give this training to science people, and that's when they just completely take off. I would say that probably the peak moment in which certainly all the people was aware that science or the picture of science was grounded inside itself and not anymore in a humanities perspective, I would say, I guess, is with the papers of Einstein in 1905 about relativity, and I would say with the theory of the atom from Niels Bohr in 1911. That is a moment in which these two men, even if they were doing some philosophical works and they were much in favor of having a humanitarian view about science, even though they were the ones who really kicked the ball and put the ship in a direction, they never came back from that. And of course, you have quantum mechanics in the 20s and all the other, you know, biological and everything, and just now it's gone. What time is now?
11.
Oh, yeah. We finish. So,